budget reform to order. Today is Tuesday, January 28th. We will enter into a brief work session on House Bill 2127, which is a juvenile crime prevention bill that is probably better placed in Representative Cruz's Committee on Health and Human Services. I will open the work session and accept a motion, Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2127 to the floor without recommendation as to passage, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services without prior reference subsequent to the referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Morgan has moved the bill to the House floor with a subsequent referral to Health and Human Services without prior reference subsequent to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objections?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you say to the House floor or to the Health Committee?
It has to go to the House floor first and then be referred.
In the spirit of bipartisan support, that's an incredibly important move. I will support you in this.
If you want to get Representative Merkley out of here at 3:50, I suggest an aye vote. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. We will close the work session on House Bill 2127, and we will begin our informational meeting with the invited testimony of Mr. King. Please enter. Sign in, please.
Thanks.
And thank you very much for being here, sir.
Thank you for inviting, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And I want to thank you for the opportunity for, I don't know why I should be thanking you here. I have 2 days of work to do, but I want to thank you for the opportunity to really kind of go over the private sector market and OMIP and Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, and give you kind of a background to what we sometimes call the private sector component of the Oregon Health Plan. Two things before I start, or really three things. First, I want to give recognition to Kelly Harms, who is sitting behind me, who I was in Washington, D.C. on Thursday and Friday, emailing and calling and saying, assemble this, assemble that. When I came back Saturday night, upon my chair was this stack of things. And starting Monday morning, she started putting this book together for me and was able to do that in the last day. And so she will have a variety of questions or answers for you when I do not. The second thing is I want to tell you that I bring about 13 years' experience in the current position I have, but I'm not the expert on private sector coverage. There are technicians, Peggy Annett, Barney Spate, the Bruce Bishops of the world, people from the insurance division, who probably bring a lot more technical expertise than I do. What I do bring, though, is 13 years of meeting with agents, small businesses, people with very serious medical problems through the high-risk pool, working with, again, individuals, agents, and businesses, and trying to get through the maze of health insurance. And I like to say that the folks in our agency kind of have the pulse of the local communities. We get out to Burns, we get out to La Grande, we get down to down to Gold Beach, up to Astoria. So some of what's reflected in here may not be technically correct, but they sure are correct from the perceptions of Oregon citizens, both the individuals as well as the business owners as well as the people within the industry. First thing I want to do is walk you through a book. This is a resource book.
We have very bad audio in here, so if you can pull this up as close as possible to one mic.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hold on just a second. Did you get that well enough?
I have it good, but you can't hear it out there.
Okay.
I want to walk through the resource book before I start the presentation, because we may want to refer back to some of the sections. We put together a variety of materials for you to look at your leisure. In the left-hand pocket is the member handbook for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the state's high-risk pool. In the first section, we'll have an IPGB, that's the Insurance Pool Governing Board Agency Overview, which gives you all the information detailed about FIOP, marketing information and outreach. Section 2 are FIOP guidelines. If somebody says to you, what's 125% of poverty, what's that mean in terms of hourly wage, monthly wage, annual wage. Section 2 will give you that information. Sections 3, 4, and 5 are three studies that have been put out about national studies on health insurance and small business and large businesses and recent trends and what people are doing in terms of addressing some of the premium increases. But three major studies, two of those are by Kaiser Family Foundation. Section 6 is a glossary of terms. If somebody says we should do a POS kind of delivery system as opposed to an HMO, both those terms are in there. I find it, and our staff find it, very helpful. Section 7 is a list of health insurance mandates. It's a paper published by the Insurance Division, which we'll refer to later. And it'll list all the benefit, coverage, and provider mandates that are required by Oregon, as well as cite studies done throughout the country that relate to the cost of those mandates. Section 8, we'll talk about that at one point, is a request for proposal where the Insurance Pool Governing Board is going to try to develop some definitive information about Oregon's group market. We know nationally what goes on, but what we don't know is how many people in Burns provide group coverage, what level of benefits, how much do they contribute to their employees, what do they do in Pendleton, what do they do in Bend, what kind of industries, what's the wage levels. Again, we have national data, but we're really going to try to look at what we can gather for Oregon specific. 9, 10, and 11, and Representative Bates may help me with this, put out by, I believe, the Institute of, I always forget, Institute of Medicine. And it's three small papers on the impact of having insurance versus not having insurance and what that means in terms of living longer, what that means in terms of getting care for chronic conditions and the impact of that, and I think are well worth the read when people say you can get your care by going to the emergency room. That may be true, but the fact is you will not live longer. You'll live a shorter length of time. The fact is you will not live as in a more healthy condition than those people that have health insurance. And three good papers that I encourage you to read. We have on Section 12 an OMIP stat pack, which gives you a whole bunch of information on the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, loss ratios, assessments, what plans people enroll in, what some of the demographics are. Section 13, health insurance statistics. You want to know how many people ODS has in portability coverage or how many Medicare risk contracts there are, how many people are enrolled in Parts A and B in Medicare in the state of Oregon, which, by the way, is 495,000. How many people are in HMO Oregon, HMOs versus the other side of the market, how many domestic versus foreign carriers. The Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Insurance Division put out some good statistics. Finally, in Section 14, we have the FIOP member handbook. So if you really want to, one of the challenges I'll give you when I talk about administrative simplicity is to take a Medicaid, a FIOP, a Blue Cross, and a PEB application home with you, lay them out on your dining room table, don't have lunch or dinner, drink two glasses of wine, and then attempt to fill out all four of those. I really want to give you a whole bunch of information so you have at least an opportunity to see what our members have to go through in order to get into our programs. So that's kind of just your resource manual. Section 15, which is what we ought to start with, is the presentation. And I will go through this, Mr. Chair, and just take questions as they come. And if it's something that I cover later, I'll try to point that out. If it's something I don't cover, we'll try to address them as we go through it, Isaac. That's your pleasure.
That is. Before we begin, let me acknowledge your acknowledgement and thank you to the staff for putting this book together. This is incredibly useful, Rocky. I mean, this is great.
Thank you.
So please proceed.
Okay. Slide 2. What I'm going to cover. And first of all, we kind of came up a theme for this presentation, and the theme is the grass is brown on both sides of the fence. Public or private, folks, it's hurting on both sides. We're going to give you an overview of the private sector insurance, a picture of some of the Oregon's uninsured and insured population, how they're covered, a history of Oregon's insurance market reforms. Now, I may go in more detail than you want there, but I think it's important because we've kind of lost some of the institutional memory of what happened to the mandate, what were some of the requirements, why did it get dropped off, what's been the impact of the insurance market reforms in 1991, 1993, 1995, what happened to HIPAA, what does that mean? So I'm going to try to go through that in a summary fashion, but try to point out some of the pressures and the hydraulics that's impacted our system today and why we as a state, as well as a country, are in some of the binds we are.
If I could interrupt you just to point out, we have established a new standard in this committee for mind-numbing detail. We call it the Dupree-Goldberg standard. So, and this committee was incredibly receptive to detail. So I don't, anything you want to go in any depth, please feel free, because Dr. Goldberg and Bob Dupree did an excellent job in really giving us a background. So that's what you're here for, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll tell one little story. I'm Bob Dupree. 1990, in January, I came to work for the state, and I didn't know how to spell Medicaid, and I called up OMAP. I don't even know if it was OMAP then. It says, is there anybody that can tell me what Medicaid is? And Bob Dupree came running over. We sat down by Mill Creek on his little chair, and myself and my administrative assistant, he gave me a two-hour lesson in Medicaid. So if I foul up on anything I say on Medicaid, it remains his responsibility.
Yes, sir. We acknowledge that and agree. We feel the same way.
So I'll talk about OMIP, Insurance Pool Governing Board. There are really three components to it. I'll address the marketing, outreach, and information. House Bill 3126 by Mary Nolan and where we are on that. And, of course, Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which we call FIOP. Bill Shanley calls it FIOP. I'll talk a little bit about the insurance mandates and then the state of states. So, starting off with health benefit and insurance options, slide 5. There are a variety of ways people get their health insurance in the state, and all I've done here in the next 3 slides is really to lay out what people's options are. The first is, if you work for an employer that doesn't provide health insurance, you're not eligible for any public program, is the individual market. You can go to Blue Cross, to ODS, to Kaiser, to Pacific Care, to Pacific Source. Many of those carriers have what they call individual plans. They are health underwritten, meaning that they will take an application, look at your health status, and decide whether you pose a good risk or a bad risk. If you pose a bad risk, they'll decline you. If you pose a good risk, then you're accepted. Individual market. All of us have that opportunity to go to that. If you are turned down for the individual market, you have the option of applying to the high-risk pool, which basically says for those people declined individual coverage because of health conditions, you can come to the high-risk pool. And we provide an individual product, 4 different plans for people to choose from. And I'll go into more detail in all of these later. Obviously, if you are eligible for Medicare because of age or disability, that'll be an option for you. Again, about 495,000 Oregonians. In Medicaid, I think we have about 440,000 Oregonians in Medicaid. Then there's the small employer health insurance. If you have between 2 and 50 employees, that generally is called small employer health insurance. Sometimes it's referred to 2 to 25, sometimes 2 to 50. We're lumping it today as 2 to 20 or 2 to 50. Large employer health insurance, 51 or more employees.
Rocky, excuse me, what was the population of Medicare?
Medicare is about 495,000 enrolled in parts A and B.
And Medicaid is
440,000.
Thank you.
And I have actually the figures for the individual health high-risk pools, about 9,300. Section 13 will tell us that individual market's about 171,000. We'll get the portability market in a few minutes. It's about 25,000. The small employers, 242,000. Large employers are about 1.25 million. And I can actually have a summary of that I can give you and bring tomorrow. In slide 6, you have large employer health insurance, 51 or more, and there are really 3 kinds. First of all, let's say you have 50 employee or 51 employees, you're a large employer, you can go to Blue Cross, ODS, Kaiser, all the others, and purchase a health insurance plan. They carry the risk, you're fully insured. The other is you are, well, let's say you're 75 employees, and, you know, we think we can manage that risk just as well as somebody else. We're just worried about if somebody has $1 million claim or if our plan loses $2 million. So you take what's called kind of a limited risk, day-to-day risk, but you go out to an insurer and say, just take the large stuff above $100,000, stuff above $1 million. And you can either do it on an individual self-reinsurance basis, or you can reinsure the whole plan as a whole. One is individual, one is called aggregate. So there are a lot of companies that have moved to what's called less than fully insured plans. A couple reasons you can do that, both that and the fully self-insured plans. One, you can get out of the mandates. Number two, if you do business across states, you don't have to deal with two different regulatory environments. And number three, and probably the least reason, but you can save maybe 2%. And what you save is just cash flow of the reserves. Those first 3 or 4 months premiums when you go self-insured, where you don't pay any claims, you're able to bank and make some money off of that. So you have also some benefit and provider contracting flexibility. But the real issue is mandate service benefits. You don't have to follow any state regulation, only feds. Two, again, is that you can save that little 2%. And the three is you get out of multiple regulatory environments. But more and more companies go to the less than fully insured or fully insured plans today than they did 10 years ago, simply because of the number of mandates and the complexity between multiple state regulations.
So is it fair then to infer that if the larger companies self-insured are saving approximately 2%?
May save
2%, that's what the mandated insurance coverages cost?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't think that would be, because there's an assumption that they don't provide those mandates. The 2% is really money that they can get not from benefit changes, but just from the cash flow. They don't have to pay into the insurance company's reserves. They pay into their own reserves and are able to earn money off of that.
Okay.
The mandates may or may not save money depending on whether they actually provide those services or not.
Mr. Chair. Are there risk requirements for that group?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, risk requirements.
If they're going to be partially self-insured, they're assuming risk. Do we have any requirements upon them for that assumption, or they're just on their own?
Peggy Ann, if she's here, may be able to help. There may be some federal ERISA requirements.
Yeah.
Peggy, do you know? Hi, I knew she's here. I've warned her. Risk requirements in ERISA plans?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I represent the Health Insurance Association of America. And Representative Cruz, there are no explicit risk reserve requirements. However, under ERISA, the Department of Labor can do an audit to see whether or not the plan is properly funded. And just for your information, the DOL is doing a number of audits in the Northwest as we speak. But there isn't anything explicit. Just as another side bar to that, in Oregon, the state has regulated the public sector self-insureds, and then there's a little carve-out for fully insured MIWAs that can be subject to state regulation, and there are considerable reserving requirements that apply to those groups. And so if you would like to see a measure as to how expansive those requirements are for reserving, I'd be happy to get you a copy of that.
Okay. But for the purely dealing with the private sector, any ERISA requirements are going to be prospective. They'll look back and see if historically they've got the reserve to cover the risk, and if they don't, what?
The best way of describing it is that if you're in an ERISA subject trust or a program, the board of trustees or the board have fiduciary responsibilities, and if they do not maintain the financial solvency of the plan, then there are consequences, legal consequences and economic consequences actually that go to them or can go to them personally if there has been a significant fiduciary breach. It's based upon the pension law, essentially, and it kind of follows the same sort of standards.
And these are just random audits, or are they complaint-driven audits?
They can be random, and they also can be for cause. In fact, a member of a plan can file a complaint with the DOL to initiate an audit like that. But just in terms of a general observation, there are some of us that look at some of the small employers and wonder, when you're at the level of 75 or 100, you go self-insured and you understand that what the consequences are if you have, for example, a couple of very large claims. It's not a very pretty financial situation for a group that has not had adequate reinsurance.
I have questions over fully self-insured. You have to have fairly large economies of scale to make that work. So.
And MIWAs are?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. This is more of this alphabet stuff. MIWA is a multiple employer welfare arrangement, and it's detailed in the federal code. There are some other variations, but MIWAs are probably one of the more common group arrangements for self-insured plans.
Jeff knew that.
Excuse me, as well as large employers, because obviously the Hewlett-Packards and the Intels and those kinds of folks typically will go self-insured.
Well, maybe Representative Mark has a question.
And then I just want to clarify for the less than fully insured, when they pick up the medical, the high-risk part, is that what is also known as major medical coverage?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative March, what we're talking about is reinsurance or stop-loss coverage. And
Okay. Again,
it can be in the aggregate, meaning the whole plan or an individual. They could say, for example, we're going to insure anything above $100,000. Major medical is usually not above that. That's generally in more of the day-to-day kinds of benefits.
Thank you.
Another issue in fully self-insured that you may want to comment on for us is, this one's a little troubling to me. Insurance obviously is designed to spread risk across as broad a population as you can, and insurance companies, and for very good reasons, like to keep their risk as low as possible, and will often do what we call creaming, take the most likely not to cause claims and keep them in and keep others out. So the epitome of that becomes the fully self-insured large corporation, which has a population probably between 18 and 65, probably the healthiest part of our population, and they take them out of the insurance pool. And when you do that, if you start taking large quantities of fairly healthy people out of the insurance pool, it leaves the insurers, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and others, in the difficult position of then insuring all the rest, having lost big chunks of the part they want to spread the risk into. And I am concerned what that ultimately will mean in time to what it costs for people who are in small employers who can't obviously fully self-insure, or other individuals. And you may want to comment to that, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I think you've hit on a really interesting portion of the issue, because there's a balance between the regulatory approach that the state takes. And when you get to that large group size, which is over 50, in fact, you're really talking about the 200s, 500s plus that you would really like to see stay within your group. And the more you regulate that group, and the more they want to control their own destiny, as a lot of employers like to do, the more they're inclined, for, as Rocky mentioned, regulatory reasons as well as pricing reasons, to decide to run their own plan. The folks that are in the small employer pool or the larger employers are those folks that have the least flexibility, because they're not in a financial position to go self-insured. And so I was just looking at some data recently that, and I think Rocky's right, that the trend towards more group self-insuring, at least we're seeing some documentation of that in the insurance division's data. And it is a fine line when you take a look at, how you regulate and what the possible consequences are for that population.
Mr. Chair, do we know, what percentage of the total insurance pool, those insured in one fashion or another, are in the self-insured MIWAs, whatever you want to call it?
Mr. Chair, I believe in NIWA. There's really only one NIWA right now operating in the state, and that is United Groceries. I think they're still in business doing that. I'm not sure. So there's only one NIWA. In terms of fully self-insured, there's no state requirement for any reporting. So our guesses are really based on national trends, I think, and backing the numbers out. And the example is when I take the large group market, the small group, all these markets apply uninsured, Medicaid, Medicare against our population. I'm missing about 300,000 folks, and there's some assumption that those 300,000 folks may or may not be part of that self-insured population, fully self-insured. Maybe Peggy has a better figure.
We've struggled with that for a number of years, Mr. Chair, in terms of, and it's a matter of backing into it. The comment that I was just made in terms of some trends, though, and looking at the same reports from the insurance division that Rocky just mentioned, that I think he gave you copies of, I noticed in one of the footnotes that there is a report in March of 2002 report that there were three employers in Oregon with more than 50,000 employees collectively that went self-insured and came out of the large employer pool. And so the insurance division is beginning to get data on that when they follow up, when they see changes in the enrollment numbers being reported by the insurance companies in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, the interesting part about that statistic is two of those three employers are major health plans or hospital systems, so they're pulling out of the marker themselves.
Mr. Chair, a comment you just made, MIWA is a subset of self-insured. It isn't the universe.
Okay.
I understand. Yes. Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
L.M. Anderson. Well, if this is Gordon, this is somebody else.
That's right. We've gotten it.
I can tell the difference.
I have a question just going to the previous page on the small employer health insurance. Do they also have options of being fully insured, less than fully insured, and do any ever go self-insured?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there is a state requirement, I believe, that no plan or no employer with 25 or fewer employees may self-insure. So you usually aren't going to see that, although there will be occasion that I think you'll see 50 employees or 45 employees, but it's really the exception.
What about less than fully insured?
I think that's the exception. Under 25, I think no. Above 25 through 50 to 75, I think fewer than what we'd probably expect. But the more regulations you place on the market, the more premium increases that we see, the more that opens up the door to companies looking at those options as a way of reducing costs.
And just follow up, is there a minimum if you take an insurance plan? A minimum number of services that a small employer or a large employer, is there a difference as to
Ms. Chair,
the number of services that you can?
There are certain mandated benefits and mandated providers that must be incorporated within a plan, but there's nothing that an employer couldn't take a $10,000 deductible plan. That's, I'm not sure if that's what you're getting to.
Well, I know that Oregon Health Plan has certain numbers of services that they have to provide, and I was just curious if small employers are mandated to have mental health, prescription drugs, physical therapy.
Ms. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't think that you'll see any comparison between what OHP either Plus or Standard or the current OHP program provides in terms of what's required by the federal government as compared to what is required by the mandates. And when you look at the mandates in that section, you'll see there's nothing mandated about hospital drugs. There is mandated that if you're going to see a psychologist or a nurse practitioner, there's some provider mandates. There's some women exam mandates. There's mental health and chemical dependency mandates. You should point out those mandates are only for generally fully insured plans, not for self-insured or less than fully insured plans.
Is that a question?
I guess I'm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just amazed at that. So the laws that have been passed in the past regarding mandates do not apply to people, companies that self-insure. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Toomey, that is correct. There are a couple federal mandates, and off the top of my head, one is women's health and cancer rights. Have a mastectomy or have a right to reconstructive surgery. There are a few federal mandates, I think just one or two or three. But otherwise, if you're fully self-insured, you're not subject to the state mandates. Now, you need to be careful to don't make the assumption that that means that all the self-insured plans, you know, the IBMs and the Ford Motor Companies and the U.S. national banks don't provide those, because I do not believe that most of those companies opt to self-insurance because of the mandates. They do so primarily because of the regulatory environments that they have to operate in. You know, if they're doing business in eight states, they don't want to have plans that meet eight. They have to have a plan that's different in every state to meet every state's different laws. By being self-insured, you can have one plan covering multiple states.
Thank you. Amazing.
I was surprised to find that out, too.
Amazing.
Indeed, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think we're on the end, middle of slide six. If you lose group coverage, you have a variety of options. If you work for an employer of 20 employees or more, you will generally be eligible for COBRA coverage. That's a federal requirement. It provides basically up to 18 months of continued coverage with your group plan. You have to pick up the full cost of that. There is some surcharge for administration. It's generally very expensive. And there are some circumstances where you can get more than 18 months, but generally it's an 18-month continuation of your existing group contract. You leave the state of Oregon, you quit, you will have a COBRA eligibility to maintain the contract you have with PEP for 18 months, same benefit contract. If you work for an employer less than 20 employees and quit or fired, you have the right for state continuation. And that basically is a six-month continuation of your group health benefit plan. Again, you pay the full cost of that, and that's for a six-month period of time. At the end of that 18-month for COBRA or six-month for state continuation, or any time you're enrolled in that or at the beginning, you also may elect Oregon portability coverage. Now, let's assume that you worked for, and the best way is just to work through an example. You work for the state of Oregon. You decide to quit. You have two options. You can take COBRA for 18 months, or you could immediately take portability coverage. Portability coverage is really a state-defined level of benefits consistent among all carriers. It's a $500 deductible plan, 80-20 copay, or if it's an HMO market, it's a $20 copay. Every carrier has to offer this portability coverage if they provide a group product. So you quit, you can go to COBRA, take the same benefit plan you have now under PEP, or you could go to portability, which is the state-defined benefit plan. If you want copies of that, I will bring copies of that tomorrow. I think we can get that for you. At the end of COBRA, or state continuation, you can elect portability coverage. Okay? So portability really was started by the state in 1996 to make sure that once people were in the group market, and that when they left that group, they would have something to go to, either instead of COBRA or continuation, or at the end of COBRA and continuation coverage.
So how long does the portability last?
You may keep the portability, Mr. Chair, for as long as you're resident of the state, live in the service district, and the carrier's in business.
And then if that you elect with a commercial policy and that company goes under quits or whatever, can you then port to another commercial carrier?
Mr. Chair, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the state's high-risk pool, provides really the backup for those people that fall through the gap. Let me give you some examples. If you're enrolled in Kaiser, you leave state service, and you decide to move to Medford. Well, Kaiser's not in Medford. So you can't take the COBRA, you can't take the portability, so OMIP will provide you portability coverage. One example. Other example.
Along the same basic coverage?
Every carrier that provides portability coverage, it is the same coverage. You have an HMO product and an indemnity product. Kaiser's product is different than Blue Cross's, but Blue Cross's is the same as ODS's. Kaiser and HMO Oregon are the same as HMO carriers, so you have really two.
So if you're forced into the OMIP pool, I guess that's a little redundant, but if you're forced into OMIP, you would carry with you to OMIP the same coverage that you had with Kaiser or Blue Cross.
Portability, the same portability coverage.
The same portability.
That's right.
The defined benefits plan.
That's right. The other side is, let's say you live in Medford and you're enrolled in Providence Health Plans. And Providence Health Plan says, I'm losing money, I'm pulling out of Medford, and we're not going to be there anymore, and you lose your group coverage. OMIP will serve as the portability carrier for Providence if they're not in the service area. So both if you move out of the service area or your carrier moves out of your service area, OMIP is the backup.
Let's see.
Okay. Portability also is provided by OMIP for those people coming off of self-insured plans. Let's assume you work for Safeway, self-insured. You quit, you have COBRA. Federal law says they have to provide 18 months of COBRA. At the end of that COBRA, what happens? There is no Blue Cross or Kaiser or ODS or Providence for portability. OMIP serves as the backup for the self-insured for when people need portability. So you have portability as long as your carrier's around, or you have portability if your carrier's not around, or you're not around your carrier, or there is no carrier through OMIP. That was major legislation in 1996. And then federal legislation in 1997 expanded that a little bit, and I'll cover that later.
96, we weren't in session in 96.
Implemented 96.
Took effect in 96. 95 legislation.
Okay, others, and I won't get into association plans, restaurant association or the bar association, they all have sometimes little plans that they offer to the membership, chambers, NFIB, AOI isn't really an association plan, but they have a series, almost what's called a HIPIC, health insurance purchasing pool. There are union trusts. Champus, and Champus actually has changed its name. I'm not sure what it is now, but it's Civilian Health and Medical Program for Uniformed Services.
I thought it was TRICARE.
TRICARE. And so basically people coming out of the service, and it has an opportunity to maintain a level of coverage. Those are just the options that people have in the private sector.
Okay. Rocky, what's the major difference between an association plan and a MEWA?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, basic difference. A MEWA is generally where a number of employers come together. Association plans may be employers, but it may also be individuals, lawyers, for example.
Well, okay, but like United Grocers, Peggy, you want to come up?
Peggy,
because
Peggy.
United Grocers, there's a parent company and all of their associated stores or fall under that umbrella, so that's how they create that. But I'm just wondering what the basic difference is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, again, I'm Peggy Annett. The difference between a MEWA and an association plan is the MEWA has to be a group of like entities. In other words, you can have a group of, you know, electrical companies or a group of, well, for example, where I used to work, a group of cities. But they have to be in a similar business, and they can't be formed for the purpose of selling insurance.
Okay.
So you have to have a similar employment base within the group. The banking association would be another MEWA-like entity. In an association plan, you can have disparate employment bases within the association, like a chamber, where you can have multiple different types of employment styles that come into the chamber or AOI for that matter. But a MEWA is very tight in terms of having to be in a similar field, if that's what you want to call it, and the DOL regulations on that are quite tight.
Good, but structurally, is there a lot of
structurally there is not a lot of difference between the two. They both would be operating with the same sort of fiduciary responsibilities. It's just a question as to how you get into one versus how you get into another.
Okay. I'd like to point out that Representative Merkley is 2 minutes late to his self-appointed engagement, actually professional engagement, and he has the privilege of dining with John Mitchell tonight and probably Colin Powell on Friday. Oh. That would be exceptional. Travel well. Good job. Yeah, you're going to have a test Monday morning.
We're going to keep it all a secret from you, Representative.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Chair, slide number 8. Observations of private sector health insurance. I'm going to go through this somewhat fast. We have some charts as we get into this little farther along that will show you some examples of this. First of all, premiums are rising faster than inflation or wages. And there's a chart will be coming up in this next section that just shows you perfectly medical inflation, general inflation, workers' wages, and insurance premiums and how they just kind of don't necessarily go together. We know that in the private sector market, benefits are being reduced, cost sharing increased to compensate for higher premiums. We did studies of what we call the most prevalent plans offered in the group market, small group market, by the IPGB 2 years ago, and the most prevalent plan was a $500 deductible plan. The most prevalent plan today, we just are in the process now of redoing that study, is between $750 and $1,000 deductible plan. The reality is the 30 and 40% increases we've seen in the small group market over the last 2 years are resulting in people reducing some of those benefits and increasing the cost sharing of particular employees. Again, the premiums are shifted to the employees or the employer contribution levels are reduced. An example of the employer level reduced, we have a restaurant here in Salem, one of the few big restaurants that provides, or smaller restaurants I should say, that provides health insurance to their employees. They did pay 80% of the employee's contribution, and they've reduced that to 70, and they don't know if they're going to be able to hold on. Every year they've had to kind of pass part of that 30% or 20% increase on to the employee by reducing their amount that they contribute towards employee coverage.
Mr. Rocky, back up just a minute. As we're moving from 500 to 1,000 deductible, could you get us some information on an example of the benefits that are being removed?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I don't think there's a lot of benefits. There's a lot of cost sharing around those. For example, Rx pharmaceutical benefits, the kind of cost sharing.
So it's more a copay thing? Cost sharing.
For example, a lot of the plans used to provide a maximum out-of-pocket on drugs.
Right.
Now, a lot of the plans, most of the plans, don't have a maximum out-of-pocket. You'll pay, if it's a 50% benefit, they used to say up to $4,500, we'll pay 50%.
Okay.
Now they're saying 50% benefit, but I don't care if it's $500,000, we're only going to pay 50%. I think if there's one benefit that you see a lot of discussion around, it's the pharmaceutical. And that is provided as an optional benefit in many group plans. And you're starting to hear, and again, this is anecdotally from what we did in our survey, a lot of groups are starting to either limit or in some cases drop pharmaceutical coverage because of its added cost. I don't think you can nearly say the majority have. I'm just saying that's the wedge that we've started to open up. Thank you. Okay, wages versus benefits. One of the things that we're seeing in the small group market is employers basically saying, here's your buck an hour more. Find your own health insurance. And I'll even go as far as to call an agent who will come in and he can or she can tell you about individual health insurance and you can go get your own insurance. As long as the employer doesn't require that individual to do that with that pay raise, they're fine. They can give the money and say, go do it. If the person chooses to buy a stereo, that's up to them. They do run afoul with the law if they try to reimburse for individual coverage and tell them they have to get individual coverage. is being basically you're circumventing the small group requirements and telling people to go out into the individual market as a requirement of employment, and that is illegal under the state law.
So I'm a small business. We have small group. I have one of my employees that says, I'd rather have you give me the money you're putting in my health insurance and let me buy my own. And I can do that without violation of the small group, to say, okay, here is an option. You can take the $500 we're putting into to pay for your premium. And we can do that. And
here, Representative Cruz, there are some insurance requirements about what is a legal opt-out.
Okay.
Who can opt out of a plan and who can't? I will tell you that an insurer may have a lot of problems with that and probably would not allow opting out just because you prefer individual coverage. Under the insurance code, I don't believe that's a legal opt-out.
Got it.
Current increases. A key thing is this last bullet on page 9. The current increases, and I think it's about 90,000 in the uninsured, really have occurred in the private sector, not the public sector. You've got the same number of people insured in the public sector basically this year as you did last year. The problem we have is we're losing private sector coverage. It's the group market that you primarily see losing folks during this economic downturn. The other side of that is when we saw the insurance rates or uninsurance rates go from 18% down to 10%, it wasn't the public sector expansion that brought that down. We gained about 500,000 covered people in our state in that 6 or 7 year period of time. 125,000 of those went into the public program. 300,000 to 400,000 of those went into private sector. So the rates coming down, uninsurance rates, private sector expansion. The rate going back up so far is private sector expansion. Now the reason that becomes key is you try to figure out solutions to the uninsured. It ought to become obvious at some point, folks, and the governor's been saying this and kind of gotten the message, it's the economy, it's jobs. Good economy, profitable business creates health insurance opportunities for Oregon citizens. So we need to balance the needs of both sides of that equation. We need to address the issue with the most vulnerable, the lower income, but we also got to pay attention to where the real in and out or the churning of that uninsurance rate occurs, which is in that 100 to 200 to 300% of what. Okay, hydraulics between public and private sectors. Eligibility changes. Okay, you're going to cut 100,000 people out of mental health benefits, an OHP standard. There's a whole bunch of those folks who are going to go out and borrow money. They're going to figure out a way to pay for it, and they're going to come to the private sector market. They're going to get turned down. They're going to end up in OMIP. OMIP's going to take them in, and we're going to increase the assessments of everybody. When you make decisions about eligibility,
correct,
you make decisions that are going to impact both sides of the market. Okay, we're going to actually kick some people out of coverage. We're going to take all those medically needy programs, 5,100, say you don't have coverage, 8,500 of you. Two-thirds of them have Medicare. They were only there for prescription drugs anyway, probably. We don't worry about those. But the third that had nothing, they're going to... We do worry, I understand.
Thank you. Easy, Rocky.
I understand. Two-thirds of those, though, have Medicare. They don't have a private sector option because they're not eligible for OMIP. They're not eligible. They're not going to get into the individual market. A third of those, though, have nothing. They're not eligible for Medicare. They're already calling the OMIP phone line saying, how do I get an OMIP application? When you press a button on either the private sector side or the public side, there are consequences. There's hydraulics that occur. Cost shifting, you talked about that. We've always talked about the cost shifting of the uninsured and the state and the federal. It's going to impact. It's always going to be there, but it does have an impact. Access issues.
Rocky, let me stop you right. Could you give us those numbers again on individuals impacted by 5,100?
Mr. Chair, these are estimates at this point.
Yeah,
there are about 8,500 in the medically needy program. Mm-hmm. And our understanding from our eligibility staff and talking with DHS staff is about two-thirds of those are eligible for Medicare. So they're there primarily for prescription drug benefits. The other third is not, which means that they're going to have to turn to the private sector for their coverage. because of their needs, they would be turned down for individual coverage. And if they're able to develop the resources, then they're going to look to OMIC. That's about a third of that 8,500.
2,700, 2,800.
And of the 100,000, if they lose mental health benefits, anybody's guess. You know, somebody at 90% of poverty or 95% of poverty or 0% of poverty, if they have the needs and the resources, either through family or whatever it may be, to get coverage that they may need to live. People do things to live that they've got to survive. And so we expect that a number of those people will look to the private sector to see if they can get those benefits, if they can develop the resources. They don't have their own resources. They have to go out and figure a way through that.
Getting into OMIP is not free.
OMIP is not free.
Right.
There's some truths. Access issues.
Just a second.
Excuse me. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just take a little closer look at the medically needy program. If 28 passes, it'll be reinstated. But if it doesn't pass, and we'll be facing this issue anyway in 0305, so I think we need to flesh that out just a little bit more. The two-thirds that have Medicare, many of them are disabled people. And they're elderly people with extremely low incomes who have extremely high pharmaceutical prescription costs, $500 to $1,000 a month, which are literally keeping them alive sometimes, or their antidepressants that are important too. Those people are medically at high risk. So we want to make it clear that two-thirds who are on Medicare, these are high-risk patients and people we've all been hearing from the last few weeks and will continue to be heard from.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, my only point on that was that they don't really have a private sector option. And that actually, in some ways, limits them over those that don't have Medicare. At least those that don't have Medicare are going to be eligible for a variety of. They don't get disqualified because they're in Medicare for some private sector program. They're on the phones today. When they got the letters that their coverage may end, these are folks that generally, I mean, there are people with some resources. They're above 100% of poverty. They either are working or they have other income that makes them not qualified generally for Medicaid except for the large medical expense. So these are folks that are out there fighting and working. And they're going to fall through the cracks over the next few months if 28 doesn't pass.
Mr. Chair?
Let me just clarify one thing. Hold on a second, Carolyn. 8,500 in the medical needy program. They're in there. About two-thirds of them are in there for the prescription drug benefits.
Mr. Chair, two-thirds of them are enrolled in Medicare, so their primary medical benefit is coming through Medicare. But because of Medicare's lack of prescription drug
right.
benefit, that's what...
And they pick that up through the, quote, medical needy program. Okay.
Gene Thorne, I believe, is going to be here next week, who is really the expert on it.
Okay.
My expertise really comes from the folks calling me and saying, help. Help find me some place to land if this thing doesn't pass.
Okay. Let me give you a pro. Maybe I can make this clearer to you.
No, I've got it.
Okay.
And Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So help me understand this. So folks who are having their mental health benefits eliminated, you're saying they're going to be coming in this medical needy program. So didn't you say that? You're frowning.
No, I'm trying to understand.
Okay. Yeah. They would be applying for the OMIP, right?
No, Ms. Chair, what I'm saying is to the degree that you reduce benefits in the public side, and if people have the ability to develop resources, because mm-hmm. it takes resources to do the private sector side,
right.
and there is great enough need, you know, if I get kicked out of seeing my mental health provider, now patient care, I'm going to commit suicide. And rather than commit suicide, I'm going to develop some resource so I can continue that help, and maybe that means I have to buy a private sector policy. For the first time, and I talk about this later, for the first time in the 13 years I've been here, you're going to see, with some of these cuts, public sector programs that have less benefit than private sector. The complaint that I have heard for 10 years in the communities of working with businesses and agents and small employers and employers is that if you work, you get a less benefit than if you don't. Well, we now are reversing that. We are taking away, because of the necessary cuts, I mean, this is tough times. This isn't... nobody's trying to hurt anybody, it's just a reality, but we're taking away benefits, and for the first time, public sector folks are going to have less benefits than many of those in the private sector.
Okay, I was leading up to a question. So for those who are losing their mental health benefits, who would be coming to ONAP, right? So you were suggesting that this may happen, right?
Representative Tomei, they could have that choice. They wouldn't just automatically.
Right, I know that. I know that. Okay. And you said they would have to find their own resource for that. Can you give me some sense of how much that would cost to for them to have mental health benefits, that program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I think in the front section, there is a rate chart enclosed. For example, if you are 40 years old and you live in Portland and you want a managed care plan, the preferred provider plan, it's $336 a month for a $500 deductible plan. 80-20 copay, we provide for state-mandated mental health and chemical dependency benefits. So you're talking about $336 plus whatever out-of-pocket costs go along with that, both the deductible as well as the copay.
Great. It's good to have this. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And is there something you want to clarify there, Dr. Bates? Or Representative Bates, excuse me.
Well, whichever.
Representative Dr. Bates.
I think the thing to know about this clientele group we're talking about is that they are very low in income, and that the probability of them able to buy this insurance is about zip. To develop that kind of resources, which is, I think, is a nice way of saying it, is that they have to find some way of doing it. A profile of one of my patients would be a lady who has bilateral cancer of both knees. Her medical bill is about $1,000 a month. She is living by herself with two kids, and she brings in about $1,500 a month for the whole thing on Social Security and SSI. So she's not going to be able to go out and buy insurance to pick up the rest of her medications. And that's typical of these people. That's why they're on the medically needy program, because they really can't afford to buy into any health insurance programs. That's the reality.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I hope she is on the FEMA waiting list, although she's current, because having a medical needy program doesn't disqualify you when your name comes up. Finally, Mr. Chair, the other hydraulic is access issues. And the private sector is working well, and we've got an 85% capacity. They're all going to the docks. Providers are going to worry about that Medicaid person that comes in and potentially bumps a commercial person. If you have a 60% capacity because you don't have a lot of commercial business, then how you look at the Medicaid person that walks in the door may be somewhat different. In other words, the bed's already paid for, and you want to make sure you get the highest amount of dollars in there. You're going to primarily look for the commercial person, and that'll be somewhat impacted by what your capacity is, whether you're a doctor or a hospital. Hydraulics. Picture of the uninsured. Page 12. You saw us come down from 1990, 18% overall, 21% to children. We're now the 2002 data, 14% for adults. We haven't got the specifics yet from the Oregon Population Survey on what it is for children. But we know that it is starting to creep back up. Remember the V of this chart when we go to one, two, or three pages from here when we look at premium increases. Premium increases, the highest that occurred were 1998, 1990, and again now. Lowest premium increases we saw were in 1996. So premium rises and rising and falling really tracks with the number of uninsured that we have in the state. 2000 data on the next two charts, Oregon's population by source of coverage. Of the all of Oregonians, about 59% get it in private coverage, 14% uninsured, 14% Medicare, and 13% Medicaid. On chart 14, another way of saying that, though, is of those people that are covered, forget about the uninsured, about 69% are private sector. By poverty level, slide 15, 120,000, again, this is 2000 data because we don't have the specifics
Rocky,
on 2002 data.
Rock, thank you, Chair. On your uninsured for Oregon, do you have a sense of how it compares to the nation overall? Are we pretty much average there, above or below?
Mr. Chair, Rick, I believe that we're a little under, that it's closer to 15%, but I'm not sure. I haven't seen the 202 figures for the nation. And maybe somebody out there has some information.
But up until the last couple of years, we were trending down, and the rest of the country was flat or trending up. So when the economy was good, we were moving in a positive direction compared to the rest of the nation.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think it's about right. When the Oregon Health Plan was put in place, we had an immediate drop in uninsured because we pumped in about 140,000 people, and that stayed flat. And the gain after 94, 95 was in the private sector. The first big gain was because of increasing the public part, but then it started to drop down. And I'm not sure how S-CHIP money affected kids through the late 90s. That might have been helpful, too, but I'm not sure on that.
More marginal.
It might have been more, I don't know if it was public or if it was private there. I don't know. Probably not significant. There's been two factors here. What changed when OHP came in and then flattened out, and then the rest of the gain was the private sector.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, that was about 1993 when we first opened the door on the expansion, 93-94 for OHP. The low point in the premium increases, which we'll see in a few minutes, was 96. Population by poverty level, and this is a key little graph, we think. 120,000 uninsured below 100% of poverty. One could argue that many of those folks have access to health care, they just haven't enrolled. If there is guaranteed issue, no pre-existing condition, they walk into the door tomorrow and they can get OHP, Medicaid, then they are in S and get care that next day, then one could argue they're covered. The problem is they're not getting the ongoing preventative care that they may need, but they have access to at least coverage. The uninsured above a 200% of poverty, 146,000, a bunch of young, healthy folks there that probably could afford it. Some say that between 200 and 250% is still tough to provide if you have a family, especially where it may cost you $700 or $800 a month. That's still a tough group, but there are clearly those in that group that could purchase some level of health insurance but choose not to. Those between 100 and 200% of poverty, about 154,000 of them. Clearly, that's you're at the top end, it's easier. At the bottom end, it's tougher. There's really not much difference between somebody at 90% of poverty and somebody at 105% of poverty. There's not much difference in terms of take home between somebody at 100 and somebody at 150. AFS has done studies that show that social systems, support systems come off as your income goes up. So even though you may go from 100 to 125, you may lose other benefits that keep you basically with the same take-home pay. This is the group that the FEOP has been focused on, although it's one of the things you'll see. About a third of our people are really under 100% of poverty, folks that are eligible for Medicaid, but who choose to enroll either themselves or their children in a private sector program. Out of that 154,000, we think probably 25% may have group coverage available to them. This will become significant a little bit later, too.
Rocky, let me stop you here. I know several members of the committee have obligations, and before we start a whole new section, which I think is kind of where we're heading to, I apologize for stopping right here. Does the committee have any questions at this juncture?
Mr. Chair, I just point out, you know, if I looked at retrospectively at the last 30 years at what I paid in premiums for health insurance, and of course I'm 51 now, and had just done direct pay for all the services I've got, I would be so much ahead financially. So from the perspective of these young people looking at paying $600 or $700 a month in premium, or pocketing the money and taking care of their own health costs out of pocket, it's not necessarily a bad gamble from their perspective. So, you know, from the
I believe I made that gamble last year.
From the point of the system, we'd be better off if we had them. But you know, I can understand their perspective on it.
Mm-hmm. It takes one cancer to change your mind.
Well, like I said, retrospectively, you know, I didn't know I was going to be this damn healthy for 30 years.
Oh.
But that may change any moment.
Well, yeah. I would go bet on the next 30.
Well, but part of that, I mean, just, you know, highlights what Mr. King has been saying all day and what we're going to be wrestling with here. I mean, that prime example.
Yeah, Representative Cruz is absolutely correct. It's a gamble you take when you're younger, and a good gamble if you think about it. But yep, the payoff comes at the other end,
right,
if you have paid into the system.
Okay.
But when you're 20, you don't think about those things, do you?
I'm not going to tell you what I was thinking about when I was 20.
You and I didn't think about very much.
I don't want to go there with you right now. What I was thinking about when I was 20 was leaving off the table.
Okay, any serious questions for Mr. King? Thank you, sir. You are more than living up to the Dapreet Goldberg standard. Any other business to come before the committee?
Rocky's just getting warmed up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why I wanted to stop right there. And let's try to be on time. I know some of us have committees, late committees, and stuff going on. Anyway, no other business coming before the committee. We are adjourned.
This is good stuff.